Seattle's Morning News, and emerging from the Bonneville Crypt of History, here he is, Felix Bonnell. Although this sounds sounds a whole lot like L.A. Law to me. Remember the 80s? Felix Bonnell does. Although that seems really too recent for you.
No, it's scary how recent that seems, but it really wasn't recent anymore.
Felix put together a rogues gallery of sorts from notorious Northwest criminal trials from the what we fondly remember as the decade of excess. Felix is brought to us by the King County Library System. And you had some help from a local guy who was there, not with his camera, but with his sketch pad and colored pencils.
Yeah, you know, and we're so used to seeing all this courtroom stuff on TV with images and everything now, and that wasn't always the case. And back in the 30s, after the Lindbergh baby kidnapping trial, the Bar Association had local states ban cameras, newsreel cameras, from courtrooms. And that ban lasted for about 40 years. And so in December of 74, they allowed cameras in some Washington courts. And then in July of 76, they changed the rules. But it took a while for most judges. Judges were given discretion of whether or not to allow cameras. So throughout the 1980s, most courtrooms still prohibited cameras. So you had sketch artists like Doug Keith. Went to his North Seattle studio the other day. He's an artist and children's book author. He worked for Cairo TV and other stations back in the 80s to sketch some of the most notorious defendants of that longer and longer ago era.
Yeah, that was when they first brought him in. You can see this one particular one. I just did a sketch of his feet because his ankles were shackled. So,
wow.
And of course he was handcuffed too, and he had his jail coveralls on. I think he was one of the last to be actually executed by hanging. Yeah, he was kind of creepy. He would sit there and stare at me like I was why are you drawing my picture?
He's talking about Charles Campbell, who was arrested in April of 1982 for a triple murder. He was there when the arraignment happened in April of 1982. And so all throughout the 80s, he saw this like a rogues gallery. We have great images from these sketches he made. They're made in pencil and pen and then colored with colored pencil. Kevin Coe, Spokane, South Hill rapist who was retried in King County. And then he's committed at McNeil Island. Tony Baruso, who had been tried for fraud, but was later convicted of one of the murders of the two cannery workers, organizers back in the early 80s. One of the Wame massacre perpetrators, David Rice, who served a life sentence for murdering a family on Christmas Eve in 1985. But no matter who it was, he sort of had to maintain this professionalism and this very odd combination of being an artist in a government setting with a bunch of accused criminals. So he had a job to do. He developed his own approach in those pre-internet days.
When there's a trial usually happening, they would give us a seat, where sometimes we'd even sit in the jury box if there wasn't a jury. But the most time, we'd try to get a vantage point where we could just see, and then we would just sit, at least the way I would work, I would sit and sketch out everything in black and white and then do the color later. But since it was a trial, I had the time, I could actually do the color work right there. And then the cameraman for whatever TV station would just shoot the artwork on site, put it on video, and that was it.
So they're standing in the hallway of the courthouse, taping these pictures to the wall and shooting them with a video camera.
I used to see them doing that when I was
And it's before the Ken Burns era. There's no sort of panning and zooming unless the cameraman does it. There's no scanning. So another trial, big one in 1985. Robert Matthews had died in a standoff on Whidbey Island that the FBI had surrounded the compound of this group called The Order. So in 85, 10 members of the neo-Nazi group that he founded were tried together, all in the same courtroom, for racketeering and robbery, and it was very crowded. Doug Keith says all those people made for a Sistine Chapel of defendants and attorneys. Also gave him his first national exposure as an artist.
And my wife called me at my studio down there. She goes, "You got to turn on Channel 7. Dan Rather is talking about your drawings, because Cairo, because it was an affiliate of CBS. So they ran a story on the neo-Nazi trial, because it was a big trial, And so Dan Rather was talking to him, and there was my drawings over the shoulder with Dan. So that was pretty cool, yeah.
But it wasn't always pretty cool. He'd hear some pretty graphic testimony sometimes, and the details of the horrific crimes would really stick with him. But sometimes being in court was unusually personal for unexpected reasons. Ruth Nesland was accused of murdering her husband, Rolf Nesland.
I remember that.
Rolf was infamous for having piloted a ship in 1978 that struck and shut down the West Seattle Bridge.
That's why we have a new West Seattle Bridge.
Yeah, exactly. But Ruth was accused of her husband's murder. They actually flew Doug Keith by helicopter up to Friday Harbor for the trial. I love the idea of an artist with his pens and stuff getting in a helicopter to go cover the trial. Nesland was ultimately convicted and died in prison. But Doug had this very personal reaction to her.
But it was kind of weird. It was strange in a way, too, because she kind of reminded me of my own mom in a way. So I thought, well, here I am.
She reminded you what, in sort of mannerisms or in, I mean, how so?
Well, just her general look. She, elderly. She had the whitish hair, about the same build and stuff. Anyway, it was very strange.
Not sure why I found that so funny. Maybe my own parental background, but the idea of this artist serving the courtroom there.
You know, it's the way she disposed of the body. It was sort of, you know, Fargo-esque.
Yeah.
I'm curious to, you know, he mentioned that you get a vibe from these guys when they come into the courtroom. Did he ever try to insert an opinion into his depictions of them, into his sketches?
No, he took the journalism part really seriously, and Campbell was the one who really stood out in his mind. Charles Campbell as being really creepy. The others were sort of like, I think he said Kevin Coe was kind of arrogant. The others were just sort of detached and kind of paying attention to the proceedings and sort of dissociating maybe to be someplace else. But it's just the combination of art and law and technology. It's not that long ago that they were employing professional artists to sketch these pictures. And the pictures are fascinating. We've got more than 12 or 13 of them at My Northwest. Also some nice ones, too. He did pictures of the hydroplanes over in Tri-Cities for Cairo's coverage. Picture of Chip Hanauer, the hydroplane driver, kind of mixed in with this other rogues gallery.
Historian Felix Bunnell is with us every Wednesday on Sales Morning News. You know the drill. You go in for your annual physical, and the doctor tells you to stop smoking and exercise more. But now, they're going to tell you to stop smoking, exercise more, and lock up your guns. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. What's new about this, Hannah?
So Seattle and King County Public Health Officer Jeff Duchin and medical groups from across the state joined yesterday to announce a new collaboration, a pledge. It's a collaboration between the agencies and the medical associations to use public health approach to help cut down on gun violence.
Firearm injury and death from suicide, homicide, and accidental injury is a major public health problem and a leading cause of premature death both nationally and in King County. And although recent mass shootings have highlighted the need to more effectively address firearm-related injury and death, the fact is that most firearm deaths are a result of suicide, followed by homicide and accidental deaths.
Nugent says guns killed 683 people in Washington State in 2016, nearly 200 of those in King County, and almost two dozen of them were children. And it's clear not enough is being done to lower those numbers, he says, so they feel the medical community in our state can do more. Nugent says the main focus of their approach is going to be on prevention.
We must address prevention firearm injuries the same way we do other types of injuries and health problems, with a public health approach that includes screening, to identify patients with risk factors for firearm-related injury, educating patients and families about risk factors, firearm safety, and injury prevention, as we do for other diseases and causes of injury.
So what this will actually do, Duchin says, the next steps will include improving that guidance for doctors and nurses across the state on screening patients who are at risk. So that can mean anything from mental health issues, suicide risk, or guns not safely stored. They'll also work to make sure that the doctors and nurses are following those guidelines. As for what this will mean for you,
for the public, they should you should expect your doctors and nurses to talk to you about firearm injury and firearm safety, just like they do about risk and prevention of cancer, cardiovascular disease, and the safe use and storage of prescription medications.
Dr. Fred Rivera is a pediatrician at Harborview, and he says there's also a great need for much more research on gun violence. But he says because of a law passed in the 90s, the CDC is essentially not able to do those type of studies. So states need to act on their own.
Our legislators really want to know what works, what doesn't work. Are the laws that they pass, like the Extreme Risk Protection Order, is that effective or not? What might they be able to do to prevent firearm injuries? They don't want to just pass laws that are not going to have an impact. They really want to know also what's the cost of firearm injuries in Washington State, the impact upon medical costs, but also the legal costs, criminal justice costs. They really needed information to really figure out what might be effective and what's the impact upon the state.
He wants Washington State to follow California's lead, where about a year ago, lawmakers passed a bill that would give $1 million a year for 5 years for researchers at UC Davis to study research on gun violence. He told me that they expect similar legislation to be proposed in Olympia this upcoming session to do our own state research. Now, while the announcement of this collaboration yesterday was largely about how medical professionals in the state will work with one another and their patients to address gun violence and not so much about legislating anything, many doctors on this panel did stress their support for new laws on guns, especially a safe storage requirement, which we already see Seattle working to do on its own. And should Initiative I-1639 get enough signatures to qualify for the ballot, will be a statewide issue that's put to voters here in November.
So anticipating the emails I'm going to get on your story, Hannah, are the doctors also going to remind people to be careful with their kitchen knives when climbing ladders, to put non-slip mats in their tubs, slow down while driving, stuff like that?
No, but he did actually, when talking about this yesterday, said this is something, he compared it to the requirement for seatbelts, right? So years ago, we didn't wear seatbelts when we were in the cars, and now the requirement that you have to have those seatbelts on has lowered deaths. So he's talking about it like that issue. And also the big push when we're talking about opioids, right? We're telling parents not to leave their extra pills in the medicine cabinet. That kind of a discussion is what we're talking about. Nothing about mats or knives, though.
Oh, and because I know that Dave Workman is writing a note to me right now, your first line said that guns killed 683 people in Washington State in 2016. People with guns,
yes.
Killed other people, okay.
That is absolutely correct. I also want to point out quickly that this public health approach that we're seeing them go after in our state comes about a week after the American Medical Association came out and took some pretty new positions, the most firm positions they have so far on guns, including backing a complete ban on so-called assault weapons, among other things.
There are also high lead levels at gun ranges, right? Which is also dangerous.
Yeah, it is absolutely dangerous.
Thank you, Hannah. I think we covered it all there.
I think so.
Kai Radio's Hannah Scott. We go to the White House first. Everybody agrees that separating families is not a great way to handle the tide of migrants crashing into our southern border. But who's going to stop it? CBS News correspondent Major Garrett joins us every Wednesday morning. I asked him what, if anything, Congress is going to do about this.
Well, the question is, can Republicans figure out what they want to do, and can the White House decide how much of a immigration deal at once? The White House has been pretty clear, and I will tell you, it may not be clear going forward, but so far it has been. The president won't sign a bill that only deals with this family separation issue. He wants other issues dealt with. Among them, of course, more funding for his much-coveted border wall.
Yes.
And other changes to legal immigration, changing the visa lottery system, changing what's so-called chain migration or family reunification. There's no discernible bipartisan support for those other big ideas. So you might be able to get something through the House, but can you get something through the Senate? The Senate Democratic leader said last night in a statement, nothing the president supports can pass. The things that can pass, he won't support. So don't blame Democrats for a Republican-led Congress inability to act.
Now, are the Democrats secretly loving this or not?
Some, yes. But look, there are some red state Senate Democrats up for reelection who are going to have to be careful on this issue, because there is, and President Trump's election in 2016 at least indicates, a sufficiently large enough portion of the American population that, if not totally supportive of this particular aspect of his immigration policy, is generally comfortable with it and wants a harder line. And Senate Democrats in red states, meaning states that President Trump carried in 2016, are probably going to have to navigate this more carefully than others. And those politics haven't shaken out fully yet. There are some bipartisan Senate meetings scheduled for today and later on this week. They were there 2 or 3 months ago. They came to nothing. Perhaps in this crisis atmosphere, there will be more imperative, or at least a more initiative, to put something together that both parties can vote for and vote for in public, as opposed to just saying quietly in a closed room, yes, maybe I might support it. We haven't seen that kind of clarity yet.
Right. One more thing. I heard Rudy Giuliani on Fox last night saying that the release of those thousands of additional emails from those two FBI agents who clearly did not like the president and, you know, threatened to prevent him from getting elected, that pretty much torches the Mueller investigation. It shows that the investigation was started under false pretenses and that it is hopelessly biased and that it's just going to collapse. Are you hearing anything along those lines?
Well, certainly that is one of the allegations leveled by some of the president's Republican supporters in Congress. And it's true that these two people, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, worked on the Hillary email investigation and then somehow got on the special counsel's investigative team. They're both off, but they were there for a while. And that does raise questions about their overall orientation, both to the Hillary Clinton email investigation itself and the beginnings, the very initial beginnings of the Mueller investigation. But we have to remind ourselves of a couple of things. The Mueller investigation has gone on, and people who have been charged have pled, or they're in the docket and are being adjudicated. There's nothing that has been raised about that investigation itself that's off the rails. Nothing. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, I was there at the rallies when, after James Comey, the FBI director, reopened the investigation in the latter stages of the campaign, candidate Trump was praising his courage and his guts and his ability to see clearly that there was something there. Hillary Clinton has blamed James Comey for, at least in part, creating an atmosphere that would make it difficult for her to win. So in the end, if you're looking at the bottom line of what happened, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page didn't stop anything from happening, didn't stop James Comey from reopening the investigation, didn't stop that reopening of the investigation having a negative political effect on Hillary Clinton. So they exchanged lots of messages that certainly betrayed their personal bias against Donald Trump. But did that affect to harm Donald Trump in the latter stage of the campaign? The evidence of that is very hard to find.
CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett, who joins us every Wednesday morning. He's also host of The Takeout, which you can hear every Sunday on Cairo Radio. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I didn't really expect this. We got a note that the United Methodist Church is filing charges against Attorney General Jeff Sessions. This is an effort that's been spearheaded by Reverend David Wright, who was an elder in the United Methodist Church and a chaplain at the University of Puget Sound. And Reverend Wright, tell me what's behind this.
Thanks so much. The one thing to be clear is that the charges aren't coming from the Methodist Church. They're coming from a group of around 639 of us, clergy of various sorts and laypersons. We're seeing the news last week, especially around what's been happening at the border with children and families being torn apart, and trying to think about what can we do? What's a concrete anything that we can do to stand up against this? And we realized that there's a very small and unknown and unutilized piece of church law for us that allows us to bring a complaint against a Methodist layperson.
Now, what proportion of the church clergy does that represent, do you know?
A tiny fraction. I'm not sure of our numbers. They're globally are around a total of, I believe, 8 to 8.5 million Methodists globally, laity and clergy. But the response was beyond anything we dreamed of and went national very quickly.
Now, is this because the Attorney General quoted Paul's letter to the Romans as justification for the policy? Is that what brought this about?
That was one of the pieces that moved it. In doing that, he's someone who is very clearly identified as a part of our denomination for most, if not all, of his life. He's very public about that. He is in a seat of incredible social and cultural and political power right now. And watching the buildup of the now years of acts of anti-immigrant and discriminatory behavior at the border balloon into this attack on families and their children in some ways that we really do believe are child abuse. Then when he brought the Bible into it and tried to speak religiously and theologically, that was the point where we really needed to respond in kind with theological charges and complaints of our own, with the hopes that that'll push him, as the process goes, to really be in dialogue with his pastor, with other church leaders, to hopefully hear the complaint and hear the concerns theologically and spiritually and scripturally that we have, and hopefully change his heart and lead him to not just stop doing what he's been doing, but to change that and try to do what's right and hurt and heal the hurt, repair the harm.
Reverend Wright, I have to ask you the question that I get asked every time I've been critical of Trump, and that is, where were you when Obama was forcing the border policy and deporting people?
With President Obama and the President Bush before him, there were all kinds of very bad things happening against immigrants and against those coming without documentation into this country. During the Obama presidency, I was active in working both on advocacy to change some of those practices and laws. I've been a board member at Tacoma Community House, which is a nonprofit that supports immigrants and refugees in Tacoma for 9 years now. And everything from protesting at the detention center run by the ICE body in the Tide Flats in Tacoma, to letter writing, to campaigning, to try to push for change in how things were being handled. Similarly with many of President Bush's policies before that, President Obama's history on this is atrocious, but nothing to the scale or level of human suffering that we're seeing enforced under the current administration.
Okay, so in practical terms, what would come of this? Supposing these charges are upheld, what would happen to the Attorney General?
What would hopefully happen is that in his conversations with his pastors and his regional church leaders, bishops and whatnot, he would have a change of heart. He would engage in a reconciling, hopefully healing dialogue with them. through his pastor's leadership and the Spirit, he would find ways to turn from what he's doing and to try to bring healing. I've been asked a lot about, are we trying to get him thrown out of the church? There's actually not a procedure for that. Mm-hmm. The actual processing of what happens next is really in the hands of his pastors and his regional leadership, and how they approach that and what they want to do with that. They may choose to include one or all of the 639 of us in the process. My guess is probably not, but hopefully they'll approach this pastorally and in a way that really gives them a chance to, as we say on Ash Wednesday, repent and believe the gospel and live a new life.
Okay, I'll ask you one more question I get asked all the time when views like this are on the show. And that is, so are you in favor of open borders? Just let anybody flood in on the basis of humanity and what Christ taught in the New Testament?
Not at all. I'm at this moment focusing on being in favor of a immigration policy and practice that is humane, that is just, that respects our own laws and our international partnerships around asylees and refugees in particular, and that has clear processes for handling with great care and compassion these people who, in most cases, have journeyed through incredible things, facing great suffering and even violence in their home countries, to try to find a place of refuge and safety that this country has, for much of its history, said it is. We've certainly failed that before, and I fear that I'm seeing us fail that now.
Reverend David Wright, an elder in the United Methodist Church and chaplain at the University of Puget Sound. Reverend Wright, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it greatly.
All right, new jams for Danny O'Neill.
Time for a Sports Insider. Brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. So you were talking with Ice Cube?
We interviewed Ice Cube yesterday. Well, I guess we. He called for our arranged interview the Big Three tournament, which he is a co-owner of and promotes, starts its second season
what
on Friday.
This?
The Big Three is, I think, you know, the senior PGA Tour?
Yeah.
We've got the guys that are, they're not competitive anymore on the regular PGA Tour, but people still want to see them golf, so they go out there. It's the basketball equivalent of that. Former NBA players playing 3-on-3 half court.
That sounds like fun.
It is fun, and Ice Cube's awesome.
Yeah.
I've interviewed a fair number of prominent professional athletes over my 20 years. The one time that I've met Ice Cube, and now the one time that I've interviewed him, legitimately nervous.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a small
kid.
Well,
he is a legend.
A small kid from a logging town, interviewing one of the seminal rappers in American history, and part of the legendary group NWA. Perhaps it's that he has the best angry voice ever. And he started the interview yesterday by saying, "Hey, Dan." Oof. And I was immediately like, "Hoo-hoo."
I think when it, you know, from what I know of you,
Mr. Cube,
when it comes to angry voices, I think you could give anybody a run for their money.
You've never heard
just,
Ice Cube then.
You know how they say visualize people naked? Visualize him as an umpire.
And then that's good. You,
yeah. No.
Well, where can we hear this interview? Podcast?
No, it's going to be on our show tomorrow.
Okay.
We also got him. Jim Moore, who works with us.
Yes.
He has a group of followers, which we've named the Morons.
Morons, yes. Yeah,
correct.
Sure.
And I got Ice Cube to address them, which is pretty funny.
Oh, that's great. Great interview. Let's talk about the Mariners. I was loath to watch the game yesterday.
Why?
I don't know.
You want to see him take a bite out of the Big Apple? Come
yeah,
on, guys.
I know, but you know, when the Yankees were up with, what, 3 home runs at one point, it was just like, ugh.
Yeah, it wasn't great outcome. It wasn't exactly ideal, but hey, they were competitive for a little bit.
Got a couple more tries, right?
Yeah, you got 2 more games. We got the King on the mound. The King is typically very, very good in New York. He has always put his best foot forward. And this led to, for years, essentially New York looks down their nose at everybody else in all things, especially baseball.
How surprising.
And they look at it and say, like, when's Felix going to be a Yankee? Because for years, that was essentially the storyline of, yes, it's cute and great that he's good for you Seattle Mariners, but at some point, he's going to come play for a real team.
Real team, right.
And that sort of thing of like, and Felix would always just go and mow the Yankees down in Yankee Stadium. It's a different point in Felix's career. The question is no longer like whether he's going to become a Yankee, but how long he's going to be able to remain a Mariner. Mm. And I'm excited to see 2 of his past 3 starts have been good. He's in a place where he always pitches great. Let's go. Let's get game 2 and then give us a chance for a series victory tomorrow.
So no brooms, Dave, but we can still celebrate.
That kills the whole broom thing for the Yankees. Well, you're the guy who portrayed the Yankees yesterday as a team of superheroes, as the, you know, the Avengers.
They're gargantuan. Yes, they are huge. Aaron Judge.
I thought the Yankee secret was that they have. Let me lay this sports to my ear. Isn't it true the Yankee Stadium has a short porch?
It does have a short porch. That is part of it.
Yeah.
That is part of it. But it's also
translate for us, that those of us that don't know what that means.
Shorter outfield fence. It's not as short as it used to be.
Okay.
The old Yankee Stadium truly had a unique configuration with a short outfield fence.
It was 400 feet, wasn't it? I remember Mickey Mantle hitting 400 foot. No, really?
Well, there are different parts of it you can hit 400 feet to, but there the outfield wall there was absolutely it was a joke. It was a bandbox.
Okay, but it stays the same for both teams unless they have some sort of movement going on.
Unless you have one team that plays 81 games there and whose players know that, hey, if I get a specific launch angle going this direction, I don't have to hit it as hard.
Then why don't we do that?
Well, we moved the fences in. We've got our own advantages. Yeah, we moved our fences in, what, 5-6 years ago?
How does a stadium go about doing something like that? Because they're all configured differently.
Get a bunch of guys,
how do you push really
hard.
No, but how do you get that approved? Because it changes the rules for when it's a home run.
I guess you would have to have it approved by baseball.
Yeah.
But I don't think you, I mean, it's not, all the stadiums are different. So it's not like, I'm sure there are some minimum dimensions where if you had 150-foot outfield or like something that jogged in there, be like, no, we're not going to do that.
That's what I'm thinking. Like the creep, it's going to continue inch by inch, and pretty soon everybody's hitting homers.
Well, no, don't forget, I mean, Colin, you talked about the differences. Look at Kansas City. They still have the ramp in center field. Green Monster in Fenway.
Green Monster.
You can't move that. I mean, it's super, super tall, but it's super, super short.
The Green Monster is probably the most unique configuration.
Where's that?
Boston.
Fenway. Yeah.
And their left field.
Well, that's to compensate because it's so shallow, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, actually, if you're into or even remotely conversant with math, you'd realize that, like, it actually means you can just hit it real high and short, and it's a home run where it'd be a fly ball out. So not the same.
He hit it too high.
Yeah.
He hit it too high.
Oh, but I got it up over the monster. Yeah, it's the same thing as a home run. It compensated for it not being short. That's not how a parabola works.
Well, if you make it
how about
really
that
high.
For a heckle? go there. You Bostonians don't even understand parabolas.
Put some barrage balloons up there.
Seriously.
Thank you, Denny.
What's wrong with you guys?
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. Seattle's Morning News. The Supreme Court made several decisions in the past week that will affect the way we vote and who we even have the opportunity to vote for. Talking, of course, about gerrymandering, when the party in power artificially draws up voting districts to minimize the number of representatives that the opposing party is able to elect. In cases out of Maryland and Wisconsin, the Supreme Court ruled on Monday to do basically nothing. They let the gerrymandered district stand for now. So to explain why the Supreme Court ruled that way and whether gerrymandering will now be with us to stay, we'll turn to Professor Richard Hassan. Professor Hassan teaches law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, and is an expert on election and campaign finance law. So tell us where the law currently stands on this.
Every 10 years, or at least once every 10 years, states have to redraw lines for legislative districts. And there are all kinds of limits on what you can do. So, for example, you have to have about the same number of people in each of those districts. You can't make race the most important factor when you're drawing those districts. One question is whether or not if you draw these lines complying with those other rules, but you do so in a way that favors one political party over another, whether that would be an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander.
Well, as somebody who's covered this for a long time, is there any mathematically objective way to determine whether gerrymandering has taken place or not?
Well, you know, it depends on what you're trying to measure. Justice Kagan said maybe it's enough to just have a really bad intent. If that's true, then a case that's coming up to the Supreme Court from North Carolina might be a great candidate for the court to take up, because North Carolina is a 50-50 state, you know, about half Democratic-leaning, half Republican-leaning. After their congressional plan was found to be a racial gerrymander, it was sent back to the North Carolina legislative body, the General Assembly, to draw new lines. They drew 10 of 13 districts to favor Republicans. They said they were doing it for partisan reasons, so that they would be insulated from a claim that it was a racial reason. And when they asked the legislative leader why he drew 10 of 13 districts Republican in a 50-50 state, he said, because I couldn't figure out how to draw an 11th Republican district.
So made no bones about it. On the assumption that this would blow out the racial excuse.
Right. So if you're looking for a case of a partisan intent on the record, this is the case, right? We'll see. That case is now listed for the court's next conference.
Do you think there is any kind of remedy for gerrymandering? At least with race, we do census surveys, and you can actually plot out which areas are, you know, majority black, majority white. But over time, I mean, multiracial people, how do you count them? I mean, I don't really understand how you would ever come to a satisfactory objective conclusion on this.
The other way of looking at it is this. There are some states like California that have redistricting commissions. They're not perfect, but none of the states with commissions end up producing the maps that have these most egregious kinds of gerrymanders where one party is able to have power and keep power even if it's no longer getting a majority of votes. And so in those states with an initiative process, there's a kind of workaround. In other states, there's not going to be. And this is going to continue unless either the Congress or the Supreme Court steps in and puts some rules in place.
Right. I should point out that Washington State does have a redistricting commission, which is half Republican, half Democrat. And the way they do it is, at least the way it worked last time, was they, among themselves, agreed on which districts would be majority Democrat, which would be majority Republican, and which would be swing. And so far, anyway, it hasn't been challenged.
Well, you know, that creates another problem, which we had in California about a decade and a half ago, which was a bipartisan sweetheart gerrymander. Then, of course, you know, everybody gets a safe district. You know, declare a ceasefire. And there are questions about how good that is for representation.
Yeah.
So there may be no perfect plan. But in terms of the ones that are the worst, you know, you could look at the states where it's really one party that has unified control over the government and they draw their lines to maximum advantage using the best technology and, you know, the most venal approach to politics.
You think one day there could be a certifiably objective AI program that would just do it automatically?
People have been talking about this for decades, whether we could just depend on computers. I don't think so, in part because, remember, it's not just a mathematical question about putting the same number of people in districts. You have to comply with the Voting Rights Act, and that means you have to be race conscious. And race and party overlap in so many important ways, especially in the South, that you know, if you just had random districts drawn, I think a lot of people wouldn't be happy. And also, we want legislators to represent certain interests.
Anyway, have you given thought to the idea of virtual online districts, where you basically sign up to a point of view and district people that way and get rid of this outdated geographical basis for doing it?
Well, there's another way to do that, which wouldn't require, you know, something as fancy as online voting. We could have what they've just adopted in Maine, which is ranked choice voting. You have multi-member districts. So instead of a single representative being elected, maybe you're going to elect three or four. And you let people vote for their first, second, and third choices. And then you use people's second and third choices to try to let those who have maybe a strong first choice of a minor party candidate, if that minor party candidate doesn't get a high enough threshold of votes, you go to their second choice. And some people think this is better. Others think it's more of a way towards proportional representation, which, of course, is not the history that we have in the United States.
Professor Richard Hassan teaches law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Professor Hassan, thank you very much.
Thank you.